Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today we'll hear about the 46th installment of the annual Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series, Beyond Time, Ancient Africa, History, and the Black Imagination. It's set for Saturday, February 21st at the Paul Robeson Campus Center in Newark.
It's going to be a special one. This is also a year that we are celebrating Dr. Price's 80th birthday, or we're continuing that celebration. Though he's not with us anymore, his legacy, of course, lives on.
Commentator Mildred Antonar gives her thoughts on where we stand with DEI, and film critic Harlan Jacobson tells us about a Japanese film you don't want to miss.
I don't know what a masterpiece is, really, other than something that over time transcends its initial indifferent reception by critics to be hailed as one 40 years on. Think Citizen Kane. Perhaps that will happen to Kukuo, perhaps not.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. It's become one of the most anticipated events in Newark in February, the 46th installment of the annual Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series is themed this year, Beyond Time, Ancient Africa, History, and the Black Imagination. It's set for Saturday, February 21st at the Paul Robeson Campus Center in Newark. And joining us today are two of the organizers of this much anticipated annual event, and they've become annual guests on the WBGO Journal. Dr. Jack Chen, celebrated historian and the director of the Clement A. Price Institute on Ethnicity, Culture, and the Modern Experience. Always great to see you, Jack.
Wonderful to be here again.
Dr. Lacey Hunter is also joining us as always, the Associate Professor of Professional Practice and Associate Director of the Clement A. Price Institute on Ethnicity, Culture, and the Modern Experience. Welcome back, Lacey.
It's good to be back. Thanks, Doug.
Dr. Hunter, this year's NTW, you are considering the ways in which African-descended people around the world imagine the continent's past to fortify their visions for the future. And I think it's always great because when we talk about NTW, it is always sometimes looking at the past and bringing it forward to the future. Tell us about the whole idea behind this year's theme.
Yeah, this is a special one for me, and I'm now kind of bringing everybody else onto my overexcitement, hopefully. But this year, we're really thinking about, you know, how we imagine continental Africa and how that helps us tell stronger histories and more engaging histories. But we're also thinking about Africa as, you know, the beginning of humanity. Humanity as we modern humans is what I should say, right? And so this is our way of re-emphasizing the importance of our shared past and the importance of Africa in human history and our continued human history. So it's going to be a special one. This is also a year that we are celebrating Dr. Price's 80th birthday, or we're continuing that celebration. Though he's not with us anymore, his legacy, of course, lives on. And so we'll be paying some tribute to him. This is connected, or the thematic is connected to an older program, which I believe was called Time, Africa, and the Diaspora. And that one also thought about the continent, but it was really sort of looking outward and looking at what happens after the transatlantic slave trade. Fortunately and unfortunately, we spend a lot of time talking about the slave trade and the many fallouts of that. And so this year, what we wanted to do is think about what happens before, rather than allowing for a kind of gap where people are asking, was there a before? So it's going to be a really, really good day.
Lacey, of course, has been key in formulating this, and I really am so delighted to be working with her in that formulation. I just want to also jump in to say that, like jazz, traditions have to be constantly reinvented and updated by the new generations who are moving into the future, right? So we're always caught within that Haudenosaunee seven generation kind of combination where in some ways we're the fourth generation. We're trying to pay respect and honor the generations before us. But at the same time, we're knowing who the three generations, the upcoming three generations are. We already know them, right? They're already being born. They're already starting to play instruments. And we have to keep that in mind. And I think it's oftentimes within the colonial mentality of Africa or of Asia, for that matter, the thought is, and indigenous peoples, is that the traditional peoples are like mummies. They're like mummies that we are in the museum or that we somehow dig up, and their traditions have not changed, right? That they're still the same. And that's how the kind of bad other is represented, the dangerous other. The mummy is coming back from the grave and they're going to get us, you know, that idea, you know. So we want to go way past that because it only makes sense. And this is the perfect audience who understands this. I mean, basically, tradition is not, you know, a fly caught in amber, you know, from some ancient era that we dig up, but it's constantly shifting around. And we also have Frantz Fanon, who's saying that we have to go back to a pre-European colonial tradition, but at the same time, not stay stuck in that tradition. The tradition has to be given air, life, water, nourishment to really then resume its innovations that are going on. So I just wanted to kind of stick that in there because this is really the way we're approaching the traditions, not in some mummified way. In fact, we're in fact, even if it's mummified, we're trying to, you know, bring back life to the mummies and to expose them to the fresh air of what's going on now, right? So.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned jazz and you could throw sports in there as well. We always say, you know, the people they stand on the shoulders of players, whether it be historical figures, whether it be sports, whether it be music, they stand on the shoulders of those. But they're a whole different group now. You know, there are the people, they have different ideas, different goals. And sometimes we see that the generations don't, you know, can clash over these because of the traditions that go. Dr. Chen, I'd love to know what you think you've learned the most since taking over this lecture series and keeping it vibrant in the honor of Giles Wright and Clement Price, who started this back in 1981.
Well, I just have to be humble in answering that question because I did study and take seriously African American and Black studies when I was an undergraduate and when I was a graduate student. But the field is so dynamic. And so it's unfolding beyond academia in all dimensions of museum work, of course, music, everywhere else, that I'm just constantly learning. And I'm just, for example, you know, excited that that Chinua Achebe, who of course I was exposed to when I was in college, his daughter is with us, right? I mean, she's going to be, you know, so that's a living example of what we're talking about. So to me, that's what I'm looking forward to. And then the new writing and the new perspectives, the freshness they bring to these topics that we're oftentimes familiar with, but we haven't had a chance to update our learning from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, whatever it may be. So to me, that's the process is really being in touch with people who are the living, they're carrying on the living traditions. And I, you know, I have to say that as an academic, it's very easy for us to maybe kind of be stuck a little bit in the academic book learning process. And I think the tradition of the Price that I'm so appreciative of and that I've tried to do when I was doing work in Chinatown and all my other work is to really have people who are the practitioners now. And so one of the people that I'm hoping Lacey will speak about is the dance practitioner that we have joining us because these traditions are living traditions that the communities are just, you know, kind of breaking past the academic framework that oftentimes is already, you know, even if a book comes out today, that book was researched maybe 3, 5, 10 years ago, and it's taken a long time to go through that academic process. So we're trying to be fresh and more contemporary, but also not to reject the historical framework because it's just, the history really is important, and that's really in the tradition that Dr. Price and Giles Wright really worked within.
Two things before we have Dr. Hunter run down the speakers. You mentioned to me one of my favorite words, and that is learning, right? Anytime that we can learn, and when we've been in the positions that all three of us have been in for these years, that's exciting. When we learning is what keeps us going, right? It keeps us vibrant. It keeps us excited about our jobs, keeps us excited about our world. But the other thing that you mentioned too is that as you approach this and as you look at the series, it's that even though this is a scholarly event, it's presented in a way that's digestible to the average person. And I think that's the key there, because the ability that both of you have been able to do with the series is, yes, anybody can come to this lecture series and get something out of it. You don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be somebody who has written a book. You don't have to be somebody who has followed history and black culture. You're going to learn something no matter who you are. And I think that's a key to the series and why it's so well attended. So, Lacey, give us the rundown on the speakers that Jack was talking about.
Absolutely. So Jack already mentioned her, but we're all really excited to meet Professor Achebe, who is the daughter of Chinua Achebe. For anybody who is listening or watching this, if you're unfamiliar, Chinua Achebe introduced the so-called Western world to African literature. Prior to that, when people thought about, say, Black literature, they might have read, say, Richard Wright, and later, of course, James Baldwin. We know of Toni Morrison. But Achebe really introduces at least Western Africa to the US American reader who's interested in Black literature. And of course, his connection to so many other brilliant African, continental African writers, like Wole Soyinka and so on, right? Ngugi wa Thiong'o, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Those writers have given us so much more to think about in terms of the imperial dynamics and so on and so forth. And so Professor Achebe is coming. And she's going to present on one of her latest works, which thinks about the various roles of women in early and ancient West African societies. And this, I think, is going to be spectacular for folks because we are often told that women have always been subjugated and, that somehow women's rights or women's liberation is a novel thing that surfaces maybe in the 70s, perhaps in the 20s, or perhaps in the late 19th century. And what her work shows us is that no, in the ancient world, the gender dynamic is a lot more fluid than we understand. So you literally could have woman kings, right? Right? And that wasn't a contradiction. It wasn't thought of as an oddity. You could have whole societies that worshipped deities that were women. The way that people described particular traits in nature was in what we would describe in the Western world as the feminine, or that there might actually be an absence of gender in terms of pronouns, right? So maybe you wouldn't say my daughter, my son, but you would say my child. So she's going to come and talk to us about those things, and she's really dynamic, and I think people are going to enjoy her as a part of the start of our day. And then we're going to bridge to the imagination part, because for so many people in across the Black diaspora, there's just so much we don't know beyond the slave trade about the continent of Africa, and even what we do know is sometimes taught in an imbalanced way. So that we have these impartial narratives about how the slave trade develops and where power lies and all those things. And so Nnedi Okorafor, who is a brilliant sci-fi fantasy novelist, writer, and the author of the last two Marvel, I think, graphic novels for the Black Panther movies were based on, she's going to talk to us about how she is using very early ancient African mythology and folklore to develop her characters and these storylines that I think in some ways make an imagined Wakanda a more real place for us, right? Like when we put those two conversations together, it tells us that yes, this is something that we are imagining, but also much of this is possible, right? The use of technology in the Black Panther films, although it wouldn't have been the kind of mineral that's described there that's used in the ways that it gets used, right? It might have been something else, like the use of particular metals, right? We know archaeologists have told us that there's metal working and metal use in parts of Africa that we previously had not known, which means that there are technological innovations there before there's society in Mesopotamia, where we often start, right? Or before there are societies in Greece and Macedonia, et cetera. We also know that there's a relationship between very early African societies and Chinese societies, right? That there's a not only an intellectual exchange, but a product exchange that doesn't have anything to do with the slave trade. So it's nice to have Professor Okorafor come and really help us think about the heroes that she's portraying in her stories. Some of them are young girls. My favorite is the character Binti, but some of them are characters who are disabled. Others are characters we might not necessarily pay attention to in life, right? They might not be the person who's the most visible, but they're the center of her story and around their perspectives or through their perspectives, right? We're learning something about that early world, that generational knowledge. We're learning something about how early societies have understood water and land, life and life cycles, human relationships, love, loss, all the things. So that's going to be a really nice end to that first session. And then I am very, very, very excited about Isalama, Dr. Isalama Archijuf. She is a Afro-diasporic and West African dance historian. And she's going to help us think through other ways of historical record keeping and historical narrative, right? How we tell stories through body movement. I think for a lot of Black folks, they're like echoes of what you would call cultural retinence, right? What have we retained from our ancestral past that we don't have the language for? And usually people will point to dance evolution in the Americas and say, oh, there are the connections, right? This dance move looks like that, or this one looks like that. And you find these connections actually across the world. And of course, their earliest emergence happens in particular parts of northern, western, central Africa. And so she's going to help us think about that, right? What stories are we telling? What histories are we keeping alive and sustaining through the dance practices that we maintain, but also these very traditional dances that now we think about as, folk culture. But really, that's history. Right. Right. They're telling us something about joy and despair, about fellowship. They tell us stories and they keep those stories as we are, whoever we might be, right? As we're learning these movements and as they're carried on. So we have our three speakers today, and or not today, but this year, instead of four speakers, but they're going to be absolutely dynamic and you're going to enjoy them. So don't miss it.
Once again, the 46th annual Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series is Saturday, February 21st at the Paul Robeson Campus Center in Newark. That's at 350 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. You can see my entire interview with Dr. Jack Chen and Dr. Lacey Hunter on the WBGO YouTube channel. There have been plenty of discussions surrounding DEI in the past couple of years. WBGO commentator Mildred Antenor now shares her thoughts.
The post-DEI era in public education is often framed as a return to neutrality. However, neutrality in a system that historically is built on inequity isn't a blank slate. It's more like a cold shoulder. As diversity, equity, and inclusion departments are shut down, the first casualties aren't just administrative titles or elective seminars. They are the research grants and mental health initiatives designed to help those most likely to fall through the cracks. And those groups are almost always marginalized students of color and LGBTQ+ youth. When we terminate mental health research, specifically targeting these groups, we aren't just saving money, we are losing visibility. Research grants provide the data necessary to understand why certain demographics experience higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide. Without this focus, we revert to a one-size-fits-all approach that, as we know, historically serves the majority while ignoring the variations of trauma that students of color and LGBTQ+ students often face. The human cost is measured in isolation. For an LGBTQ student or a student of color, a dedicated mental health program is a signal that says, I see you, and your specific struggle is valid. You are not invisible. Removing these support systems sends the opposite message. If this direction continues, the future for these students looks more and more unstable. For example, students from marginalized backgrounds will be forced to spend more emotional energy navigating hostile or indifferent environments, leaving less for academic achievement. And without data-driven interventions, the disparity in suicide rates and substance abuse among LGBTQ youth is likely to widen as the early warning systems provided by specialized research are dismantled. The shutting down of DEI under the guise of fairness ignores the biological and psychological reality that stress is not distributed equally. By stripping away the research that helps us understand the mental health of marginalized youth, we are creating a vacuum, and dare I say, tragedies waiting to happen. In this vacuum, the most vulnerable don't just disappear, they simply suffer in silence. They become invisible. Their struggles go unrecorded and their potential unreached. We are trading the long-term well-being of our future citizens for a short-term sense of political comfort. Just because we pretend the problem doesn't exist doesn't mean that there isn't a problem. But a glimmer of hope, or what I like to call first aid, is in the form of several nonprofits that have stepped up to bridge the gap. These organizations focus on peer support, healing and identity-affirming care, and one such group is the JED Foundation, a leader in suicide prevention. The JED Foundation partners with high schools and colleges to build safety nets for students contemplating suicide. Another nonprofit worth mentioning is the Trevor Project. It's considered the gold standard for LGBTQ+ crisis intervention. They offer 24/7 counseling via phone, text, or chat. They also maintain an active research wing that continues to publish data on specific mental health challenges of queer youth. These organizations focus on healing justice, and healing is something that we are in dire need of right now. I'm Mildred Antenor.
Mildred Antenor is a professor and the author of The Gladioli Are Invisible, a memoir. By any recent standards, 2025 was a good year for film, but overlooked in this area are a few extraordinary films where the organizing principle was the backstage drama. Here's our film critic, Harlan Jacobson.
The most prominent of these is Richard Linklater's extraordinary Nouvelle Vague, which follows the late Jean-Luc Godard as he films Breathless in the streets of Paris in 1960, which launches a new wave, literally, of street-level filmmaking that intuitively matched the overdrive culture launched by rock and roll and about to explode into the modern interconnected media world we live in today. Of course, it wasn't nominated for anything. It's in French, and it's about Godard, who was Godardian, and Godardian is synonymous with elitism at the Super Bowl party. So let's push on in this vein to another film, which is opening today, Kakuho, set in 1952 in post-war Japan, in the world of kabuki theater, the 17th century Japanese form of opera. The screenplay, by Satoko Okudera, is based on a runaway best-selling novel in Japan by Shuichi Yoshida, brought to the screen in the third collaboration with director Sang-il Sea. The story is set in the household of the Grand Master of Kabuki Theater, Hanjiro Hanai, played by Ken Watanabe. The Japanese international film star, who played opposite Tom Cruise in Ed Zwick's The Last Samurai in 2003, top-lined as General Kurobayashi in Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima in 2006, and with Leonardo DiCaprio and an all-star cast in Christopher Nolan's generation-defining film Inception in 2010. The heir to the title of Grand Master is Hanai's son Shunsuke, but after seeing a magical amateur performance by Kikuo, the son of a Yakuza gangster, the master takes the Yakuza's son into his house and under his tutelage when the boy is orphaned. This sets up a rivalry for who becomes the king of Kabuki that takes shape over the 50-year span of this grand edge-of-your-seat epic struggle.
あんたが横から安次郎の名跡かっぱらったんだと思ってる。
本物の役者になりたい。
どんなに辛いことあっても。
I'll translate this short clip from the film. He's extraordinary, says the corporate backer of the Kabuki troupe after seeing the young ruffian's audition. But what about your son? It is Kakuo who will replace me, says the dying grandmaster Hanjuro. In their eyes, Kakuo stole the Hanjuro name from the family. I want to be a real actor, Kakuo says. All you have to fight your detractors is the art of Kabuki itself. At stake is recognition of being the great national treasure, which is what the title of the film Kokuho means, great national treasure. This is no small task. It is more than just mastering the precision of the song and dance of mythic operas, already defined by three centuries of legendary performances, as one in the West might have to stare down the ghosts of Maria Callas singing Tosca, Joan Sutherland, Lucia de Lammermoor, Leontine Price, Aida. In Japanese kabuki, it is a story of the onogata, men singing and acting the parts of tragic heroines, stemming from the 17th century shogunate ban on women performing on stage. The two onogata performers vying to be crowned as the master's successor, two brilliant performances by Ryo Yoshizawa as the adopted challenger and Ryusei Yokohama as the legitimate heir apparent. Backstage, they're male as male can be. You'd think you're watching two guys duking it out in the locker room to be the pitching ace of the Yomiuri Giants, Japan's New York Yankees. On stage, they perfect the release of feminine passion in graceful suspension of song, leg, and dress. The erotic undercurrent in Kokuo is not homoerotic, but one of gender fission, masculine, feminine. It's easy to simply get lost in this toggle between backstage and onstage, between which son, the biological or the adopted, is willing to sacrifice more for his art. But this epic 50-year story pointedly begins in 1952, and a Japanese audience understands they are seeing the great post-war struggle between legacy and meritocracy, between high-born and low, when Japan saw the rise of the corporate state and comes to terms with the failure of the divinely based Imperial Japan that led to what the young Yakuza son recalls here as the A-bomb disease that claimed the life of his mother. Kokuho is shot brilliantly by Sofia Nelfani, who mastered the art of intricate intimacy in Blue is the Warmest Color, the 2013 Palme d'Or winning lesbian love story, who, with editor Tyoshi Imei and the production designer, art director, and kabuki creative director Gunjiro Nakamura IV, creates something magnificent here. One early scene is choreographed chaos that sticks a landing in a perfectly composed still of a beautiful murder. I don't know what a masterpiece is, really, other than something that over time transcends its initial indifferent reception by critics to be hailed as one 40 years on. Think Citizen Kane, Vertigo, even Jean Dielman. Perhaps that will happen to Kokuo, perhaps not. It was the highest grossing live-action Japanese film in country, which does not suggest masterpiece, but it was the Japanese nomination for Best Foreign Film sent to the Academy's selection committee, which yawned and sent it packing. I am reduced to two bars of success for a film. One, did I think of Donald Trump and our debased corruption of government once during the 3 hours that I was transported elsewhere? That's the low bar of success. And two, is the film thrilling? Is it beautiful? And is it ambitious about something bigger than its thrilling, beautiful self? That's the high bar of success. Kokuho effortlessly leaps over both the high and low bars. It began in Cannes last May and opens this week at the Angelika Film Center in Manhattan and in Los Angeles. See it before it's gone. And I'm Harlan Jacobson for the WBGO Journal.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. Plus, this Sunday is Super Bowl 60 between the New England Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks. My latest guest on my podcast, Sports Jam, will deal with the Super Bowl. You can hear from Fox NFL analyst and three-time Super Bowl champion Mark Sklareth and Hall of Fame writer Jerry Eisenberg. Both give their thoughts on the big game. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.